Well, the world is a dumpster fire. Nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good. And you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard, and it's my birthday. That's right, September 4th, every year. And this year, I'm not ashamed to say, I am 43, and I never thought I'd be 43, and here we are. Let me tell you a couple of things that I've learned. I've learned a lot of things about myself that I did not like pretty quickly. That's pretty easy to do, right? If you just sit down and you start going through your inventory as a human being, it's pretty easy to look at the things that you don't like about yourself. So I got that down. The thing that came to me much later, and I'm talking, you know, 6 years ago, maybe, was figuring out the things that I do like. Figuring out the areas where I'm getting it right. And coming to the realization that you're never done. I think the biggest thing that I've learned in my life was to hold no logical positions that cannot be changed with new information. And that's it. That is the single most important thing I have ever learned in my life. If something bumps up against your worldview, test it. And if you find out you're wrong, change. It's really that easy, and it makes life much more of an adventure if you're a person who asks questions at all times versus being a person who does not ask questions and already has the answer in their head. And you can talk to yourself in all kinds of negative ways. If you're the kind of person who thinks that you know something about yourself, that you really know it. I'll give you an example. When you're talking to yourself and you say things like, you know what, I'm a person that's terrible at math. I just can't do math. You've told yourself a story. And there may be some elements of truth, but that's not everything. That's not the whole story. I myself am a person who thought I was incapable of learning mathematics. I just thought I was stupid in that regard. And I told myself that for my entire life up into adulthood. I didn't decide to go to college until I was 40 years old. I had to learn algebra. And my math scores were so low that I couldn't even take the entry-level math class. I had to take the one below that. And that one was a big struggle for me. I tried reading books. It's like I almost have number dyslexia. When I see too many numbers on a page, they all jumble around and I get confused. But the other thing I found is through determination and will and a lot of anxiety and stomach cramps and crying, I got better at it. And I passed my math class. And I passed it with an A. And I don't think I've gotten an A in math. Ever. I know, you're probably asking by now, what is the point of all of this? The point is, we tell ourselves who we are all the time. But instead of making statements, instead of saying, that's what I'm like, why not learn to ask some questions? Like, why do I think that? Or, I wonder why this is so hard for me. that opens the door. Questions bring answers. You're never going to learn anything without asking questions first. And honestly, it's the only way to expand your knowledge, is to ask questions. If you knew everything already, you'd be the greatest. You can never know everything. How exciting is that? There's new information waiting for you out there every day. Brand new things that you didn't know. I'll tell you another thing I didn't know that I learned today. Did you know that elephants will hoard fruit and wait for it to ferment and then eat it and get hammered? How awesome is that? Elephants, moose do it too. They do it with apples, and monkeys will do it. It's a crazy thing. All these animals out there just getting boozed up. How did that happen? What was the first situation where that happened? I had never considered that before today, and I found that out. The next time you have a question about something, do yourself a favor. Look it up. Educate yourself. Now, speaking of highly educated people, today on the show, we have got the amazing Ruth Carter. This story goes in a lot of different directions, and it gets pretty dark pretty quick. But you know what? If you're listening to this show as a regular, you know what to expect. If you're new, I'm going to warn you right up front. There's some discussion about sexual assault. There's some discussion about some other things that might be, let's say, sensitive, could be triggering. And I want to make that clear up front. If you're a little squeamish about such things, this might be difficult. But I'll tell you this: we have a great conversation, and there's that thing that happens when survivors of a situation get together and start talking. A lot of times, there's a lot of laughter because sometimes how surreal the situation is that you lived through is just fucking hilarious. And that's no different in the case of this today. It is kind of strange to me that I chose my birthday as the episode to bring this up. There's a lot of personal things in here, but ultimately I'm really proud of it, and I'm really, really glad to have met Ruth. And now you will.
It's good. How you doing, Chris?
Oh, great. Other than, you know, the usual technical difficulties and whatnot.
Well, it wouldn't be a podcast without it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. So, hi. Nice to meet you.
Likewise.
Awesome. What's the weather like in Arizona right now?
Well, we were having excessive heat warnings. So over the weekend, it was like 111, 113. Oh, but today it was only, 104.
Only.
Only.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I still came back from my run just drenched in sweat. It was, yeah, I was like a human salt lick.
Yeah. But that's kind of awesome, though. I mean, to be able to break a sweat like that.
I mean, we break a sweat breathing around here, so.
Yeah, but it's at least you're not sitting around. I mean, you know, it's good enough. I've been trying to get the motivation to get my running shoes back out. You know, I haven't ran in probably 2 weeks, and I definitely have to do it. I don't have the excuse of the heat being 100 degrees.
Well, if I didn't sign up for races, I would have no motivation to work out. So I always have to have the next race that I'm training for.
That's fair.
Otherwise, yeah, no, it would never happen. I would get up and be like, nope. Nope, breathing fire, not leaving the house.
So tell me a little bit about you. Or were you born in Arizona?
No, I grew up in the Northern Bay Area in California. And then I went to Oregon for undergrad and master's degree, mm-hmm. which was fantastic. But by the time I finished, it was winter and it was very, very cold. And I wanted to be very, very warm.
Yeah.
So, and there was nothing at that point keeping me in Oregon anymore. So I looked over at my cat and I said, we're moving. So 30 days later, we were in Phoenix, and that was in 2004. So I've been here for like 15 and a half years now.
Wow. Yeah. Hey, that's awesome. At least you got to go somewhere that you picked.
Yes, I did get lucky in that I did get to pick where I wanted to live. And then,
yeah.
I was about to say, here I am. And no, here we are as I walk past my 12-year-old basset hound who's flopped down in front of a fan.
Yeah. You know, I never understood nativism, you know, people who get really excited about where they were born. You know, that's a thing that happened to you. That's not a thing you did.
Right. Yeah, I mean, unless there's like some sort of like familial pride in it. I mean, I kind of look at that as like a little bit connected to like if there's, you know, other things related to that, not just like, oh, I was born in New York. It's like,
yeah,
good for you. Good for you. You left a uterus. Congratulations.
We all did that somewhere.
Exactly. And probably the experience was all just about the same. So that's biology. So,
well, yeah. I mean, your experience was actually quite a lot different from a lot of people and not necessarily super positive from what I understand.
Yeah. And you don't, I'm somebody who will miss cues sometimes if you're trying to be delicate and vague. So just be direct and blunt.
No, it's just okay. trying to create a, you know, a nice segue for you here.
Okay. That's again, just you could just be like, Anne, speaking of nativism, tell me about your fucked up childhood.
Well, tell me about your fucked up childhood.
Oh, God, my fucked up family life. So, yeah, so I didn't realize how abnormal my family was until I started getting older and learning that, like, oh, other people's families aren't like this. Like, I thought it was normal for parents to, you know, down a, you know, half a bottle of wine, then go pick up your kid at sports ball practice. And so it was, yeah, I don't know where I got the idea, but it ingrained in a very early age that like how like looking good and behaving properly was more important than what was actually going on. So I mean, I remember,
but like, I mean, that was your reality. That was the system that you were raised with. And so why wouldn't you think it's normal?
Right. And even things like, I remember, and I don't know what was different about me than like my sister. I remember like at Christmas time, you know, Santa, mom, bought clothes for both of us. And my sister was able to say that either she didn't like something and she wanted something else. And one of the things I had gotten was a pair of jeans that were too small. And I didn't feel like I could say anything to be like, I need a different, you know, I want a different pair. I was like 10. So
yeah.
It just was like, no, like you have to keep quiet, put up with whatever you're given and make do. And your feelings and opinions don't necessarily matter. So,
yeah.
And we were definitely under-supervised. I wouldn't say completely, you know, we weren't like wild children. But I think we were definitely, there was a lack of supervision at times. And I don't know if they just thought we were mature enough to handle things or they were just being negligent. Probably the latter.
Well, you know, that, I mean, 6-1.
Yeah, like who? Yeah, like who knows? But I mean, they created a dynamic that I was, you know, raped inside their house for 2 years, and they and I had every sign that like something was very wrong. My rapist had signs that something was very wrong with him. And my parents really did nothing. Like, as long as you had your grades up and you weren't getting in trouble in school, like everything, like nothing else really, like they didn't like go any beyond that. So, yeah.
Well, from the sounds of it, from what I understand. So, I mean, there was alcoholism, but oh, yeah. I mean, that masks a lot of things, and it definitely speaks to, you know, a person wanting to push reality away. And so if you're having this thing happen to you, you know, being raped in your own home, and exposing that truth, mm-hmm. I imagine it would be something that they wouldn't actually even know how to deal with.
No, and they still don't know how to deal with it. Even one time while it was going on, I actually like blatantly said something, and my mother just shot me down. And like he was molesting me right in front of her, like not like porn molesting me, but touching when he shouldn't be. And I said, you know, don't touch me there. And she said, you guys are disgusting, and like stormed off. It was just like, dude, like I tried to do the right thing and ask for help. And
yeah.
That basically communicated to me, like, you're on your own.
Well, and also that you're part of the problem.
Right. Exactly.
And this was your brother.
Yeah.
That's definitely not something that's inside the realm of what I think most people would deal with. But and obviously even in your own sphere of not having an understanding of necessarily what normal is, you were probably pretty sure that wasn't normal.
Yeah, I mean it was. I think I was just so young, and it came on so like little by little that it just didn't comport with what like you're taught as like, you know, stranger danger and things like that, versus like it starts out with someone rubbing up against you and you're like, well, dude, what the fuck are you doing? So it's not like they make it sound, you know, on TV or in the movies, and yeah. you don't think that the person, like that the boogeyman is, you know, your brother, like that. You just like our brains like aren't set that way, even right. though most people are abused by someone that, you know, someone they know.
No, completely. And here's the thing too. I had an understanding, myself that something had happened to me when I was young. Mm-hmm. And that was something that I didn't really know how to come to terms with until, you know, maybe a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm 42. You know, so it took a while to kind of come around to this idea and to be able to tell myself the truth about it. But it's mm-hmm. still been something that has been a difficult thing to speak about.
Mm-hmm.
So when you decided that you were going to confront this thing head on, and you're not getting the support that you should be, where do you go from there with your daily dynamic?
I mean, my family is really good at trying to like reset back to the norm when something tries to throw it off. So they just went back to like nothing.
Yeah.
And that was a system that perpetuated. So when I was 16, my brother moved out of the house. I finally like really told my parents what happened. And 6 months later, they let him move back in and into the bedroom that, you know, right next to mine.
Yeah.
So, and not, you know, no real thought of like, hey, this is a bad idea. And then fast forward a few more years, we were at a family, you know, kind of gathering vacation-y thing. My parents at the time had a second home in here in Phoenix. I was in Oregon. I was living actually at my parents' place in California. I was just after my undergrad, and we came down to Phoenix for like a long weekend type thing. My parents had owned the second home here for a while. I hadn't come to visit because Tyson lived there, so I wanted to see the house. And at one point, he and I got in a verbal fight, and in front of my mother, I said something like, he insulted me, and I responded with, "Well, you're a pot-smoking child molester." And my mother and brother both looked at me as if to say, "So?" And I was so upset that I just like walked out. Like I grabbed my purse, my sneakers, and I just walked for like 2 hours. And when I got back, my mom was like, "Oh, how was your walk?" As if I was just like going out for a stroll for fun or something. Yeah. And then fast forward a few more years, actually fast forward to 2004, my childhood mentor, who was probably one of the things that saved my life, my gymnastics coach, passed away. So I went back to Northern California for his memorial. And my parents at the time were going to be out of town, so I was just going to stay at their place. And I told them, "Would you please have my brother turn in his key so that he can't come, so he can't visit while I'm there?" And she said, like, why would I do that? He knows where the hide a key is. So like, it won't change anything. And in my mind, I thought, I'm going to take the hide a key out of its hide a key spot. It didn't like even comport with her. Like, "Hey, don't," and I like, you know, "don't let your rapist come near your child." And so I like called the police department before I traveled to say, "Okay, what are the rules in this type of situation? Like where he could be arrested for trespass or assault, or like if he comes to the house when he's not supposed to be." So, you know, things you don't think you have to do. Most people don't do that before they go on a trip to their hometown.
Right.
I got in a verbal, I won't say a fight with my mother, but we had an exchange of words, and I think I said, like, "I don't feel safe around him," and which is why I wanted him not to have a key. And she said something like, "Well, then, like, it's up to you to protect yourself," or something like that. Like super dismissive. And it actually my emotional response to her lack of empathy, compassion, understanding, triggered a relapse of my bulimia, which ended me up back in therapy and ended up actually going to like a rehab center for a week to do like a workshop on childhood trauma. I don't think my family understands like that's the type of like effect that their behavior has on me.
What do you think that is that would cause someone to be that dismissive of something like that? Do you think that there's an undiagnosed sociopathy, or do you think it's just an attempt to push away a reality that's unpleasant?
I think it's pushing away reality, but substance abuse and use is rampant in my family. Like if you don't have a substance issue, like you're in the minority. So I think there's a lot of that. I think there's a lot of untreated Al-Anon, codependency things.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of those type of issues and dynamics going on. But then a lot of denial and it's just like, nope, we're going to act like everything's fine. And when it's anything but.
So with all of this going on, how did you maintain your mental state. I mean, because you from the sounds of it, you still manage to get yourself up in the morning and get yourself moving around and doing things and interacting with people. It's and that's not to dismiss any of this, because, I had a conversation with a human trafficking survivor, and one of the things she said that she gets all the time is people saying, why didn't you just run? And it's such a dismissive question.
Right.
It completely dismisses the reality of the situation. There's a lot of reasons people stay in broken dynamics and bad systems that are not good for them, especially family.
Right.
So for you to be able to kind of keep yourself together for the most part, I mean, where are you at that time?
I mean, at that point, I probably was, barely functioning okay. When it was, early on, my grades had plummeted. I was really withdrawn, and probably was just in mostly just survival mode.
Yeah.
And thankfully I was in gymnastics, so that got me out of the house 4 or 5 nights a week, for 4 hours when you include the drive. So that put me literally in a padded room with people whose job it was to keep me from, killing myself, and put me in an environment where I did have nurturing people, and they didn't know what was going on at all. But so I'm sure I was just one of the weird kids. Why is she angry all the time? Why is she fussy all the time? But then again, when you're dealing with 30 preteens and teenagers, there's probably a lot of behavior that people just chalk up to they're hormonal teen, they're hormonal kids, and this is just, they're moody.
Yeah.
And you just kind of, you just go with it, but you also set the same expectations of this is what we're doing today. And my coach used to say lovingly, check your life at the door. Meaning when you're here, we're here to work. We're here to, do the sport, and leave your school drama, whatever, outside. And if you want to pick it up on your way out, that's your call. But that was his way of just saying, when we're here, we're focusing on this, which gave me something to do that was not thinking about my family dynamics, which again, and I felt very alone. I kind of felt like I was the adult in my life by 11. So
yeah,
in a lot of ways I was, at least in terms of my emotional needs. So it gave me a safe place. So,
and those things are important. I mean, it really might not have even been the coach's intention, to provide, that level of safety and therapy. Right. And yet there it was. That must have been really helpful.
Oh, it was. I mean, if you wanted to find me, by the time I was 14, 15, if you wanted to find me, I was, I'm short, you scan the room for him, because he's 6'1", go about a foot over and down. That's where I am. So, and many times I was Velcroed to his side, arms wrapped around his waist, and he would stand outside talking to the parents, coffee in his left hand, cigarette in his right hand, and I would be Velcroed to his left side. I had to be on the coffee side because so he wouldn't ash on me.
Right.
And I would just Velcro right to him, and he would just look down to just verify it was me, keep talking, and eventually, when they're breaking the conversation, he'd be like, "How you doing, baby duck?" I probably most adults would be like, why is this child attached to me? Give me some space. But no, he just let me hang out there every day. So, and that was just that was my little safe space. And he was somebody who always believed the best in people. So he didn't play favorites. He didn't, I don't know. He just was somebody who always looked at everybody as if they could you know, do their best and try to bring that out in them.
And that was something that you carried with you.
Oh yeah. I mean, for years he was like, he was the only person I trusted. So, and then when I went into high school, I made the decision at the end of my eighth grade year that I wanted to be a 4.2 student in high school. Like that's what, that's the GPA I wanted to graduate with. So I just made the shift to being very, very success oriented. And I, it was just like, yep, I'm going to be a straight A student. Here we go. And just did it. And yeah. So very, you know, also feeding into the very controlling nature of me.
Oh yeah. yeah, of course. Setting goals and controlling things in your environment when you're a product of having something, spiral you out of control. It's a thing that happens to a lot of people, is searching for that area where you can finally affect some change. And mm-hmm. It's turning that negative into a positive. You know, that obsessive nature can work against you, but it can also work for you if you leverage it right.
Yeah. I mean, my entire worth was based on my achievements. So, I mean, like I burst into tears at the gym, never at home. On my first report card in high school, I got one B, I had straight A's and one B plus. It was like, I had like an 88%. So like, just like, there's no way to get up to the, you know, to the A block. And I cried, and most people would be like, dude, that you got like, you know, a 3.9 basically, and you're upset. So, achievement oriented, but not necessarily in the healthiest of ways. And also started cutting myself. And that is one of the hardest addictions to break, because you are never, because like with drugs, alcohol, smoking, you can get, you can physically remove yourself from your substance of choice.
Yeah.
With cutting, you can't get away from yourself. You're always in your body. So.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And cutting is one of those things too, that feels like, it's like a slap in the face. It's like cold water. It's like relief. Oh yeah. There's reality. There's pain. There's feelings here.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's something that's like really hard to like, for that people who don't understand it, to get like, why would you do this? It's like, this is a compulsion. I do it every day. Like I get such a sense of relief from doing it. Like there would be times I would like cut myself and fall asleep. Just be like, oh, like, okay, I can breathe. It's like an alcoholic takes, you know, drinks and passes out. Like I would cut myself and pass out, but fall asleep, not because I was like losing blood or anything, but just like the chemical shift that happens when you do that. So,
yeah. Well, I mean, it's endorphins, you know, it's crossing off a task. You get the same, flood of dopamine, from cutting as you would completing something that you set out to complete. There's a sense of completion to it. I did this, I'm in control of it, and I can feel better now.
Yeah. And I think I read somewhere that there is something that happens in the body, like when you're injured, it rushes endorphins so that you don't feel the pain.
Yeah.
So same thing happens when you're, at least for me, when I was starving myself, when you're really hungry and you don't feed yourself, your body will, as part of survival mode, kick in endorphins so that, you know, so you don't feel the pain of not feeding yourself.
Right. Yeah. The human body has a lot of ways to try to kick in there and try to help you that you can also use for horrible purposes.
Yeah, exactly. And I also realized like back then, looking back, I was taking so many over-the-counter drugs. again, as a probably partly because I was in so much physical pain because I was overtraining in gymnastics, because cutting also, you know, tends to also have people who cut also tend to, like, you know, over-exercise and exercise to body parts giving out. And so I didn't realize that there was like a limit on how much Advil you can take in a day until like my mid-20s. And I had my own bottle when I was in high school. So I was taking up to, no one was monitoring me. So I was taking like 13 a day when I started being tired all the time. One of my coaches mentioned that aspirin has caffeine in it. So I started taking Advil and aspirin, not knowing you're not supposed to take aspirin until you're over 20 because it can cause like some type of disease.
Yeah.
And
how's your liver?
Oh, God. Still functioning. Thank goodness.
Knock on wood.
Yeah, seriously. And then as I got older, then there were prescription drugs and alcohol and
yay for recovery.
I just actually celebrated 15 years yesterday. So, yay.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Basically it was like anything that I could either do to myself or put in myself to make myself, you know, not have to feel my feelings.
So with all of this fucked up stuff going on, where were your role models for self-care and taking care of yourself?
No, they didn't exist. I had parents, you know, not my parents, but other parents saying, like, you know, you're going to have arthritis by the time you're 30. And I feel like a final deal with it when I'm 30. Yeah. No, there was no such thing as, like, you know, for me, like, self-care was making sure I was, like, using ice, heat, and Advil to keep my body functioning. Because I had, like, I stress fractured my back my senior year of high school. My parents thought I was lying for 3 months until they finally, like, used the line, "Do you want to go to the doctor?" thinking that that would shut me up. And I was like, yes. And then my doctor was like, yeah, that's bad. So and that's when they were like, oh, shit, our kid wasn't lying. She wasn't being dramatic.
Well, we'll call this the one time.
Yeah, exactly. I had no idea what health was. I was doing well in school, so that must be going well. I was doing well enough in gymnastics. Had really fucked up ideas about, you know, what nutrition was, didn't care. I didn't even realize that what I was doing was like cutting or in the self-injury realm, because I thought if you didn't pick up a razor blade, it wasn't cutting. Yeah. And I was doing most of the damage with my fingernails. So
yeah. Fingernails are effective.
They are. And I remember later on when I told one of my coaches that, like, what I had been doing when in my younger years, she said, "I wondered why your feet were always scratched up." It was like, yep. Like, it's, you know, and unless you were looking, you wouldn't have even noticed it.
Well, of course not. I mean, that's what makes the most sense. Because even when you're in the middle of knowing that, you know, this is the thing I do to make myself feel better, you're still kind of aware that there's something wrong with it, and it shouldn't be public.
Yeah, well, I have a theory that people who cut themselves on places that where it's going to be seen, I think they're doing it for a reason. Like, they want to be caught.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to be caught. I needed my world to not fall apart anymore. I was barely holding it together, but I was like, okay, like, I need school to be stable. I need the gym to be stable. I don't want anything to disrupt what's, you know, the things that are working for me. So I wouldn't tell anybody about, you know, everything else that was going on that was fucked up, because I was afraid that if I was, like, taken out of my home or something like that, that, like, my world would come crashing down. I don't think I totally could, like, think it all that all the way through, but I think looking back, like, that's what I was, you know, trying to do, and just like, okay, don't tell anybody, just manage it. Because of course I thought I could manage it on my own.
That's well, cute. Right. I mean, if you think about it though, a dysfunctional family is almost like a form of institutionalized lifestyle, because you're in it and it's your whole reality. You have no idea where else you could go or that you would even leave.
Right. Oh yeah. No, there have been times looking back that I wondered, like, that one day that I walked away from my family for a couple of hours, like, what would have happened if I just never went back? Like, what if I had, it never occurred to me not to do that, but I have had that thought of, like, what would that have been like had I just, like, walked away from my family and been one of those people who chooses to be voluntarily missing?
So how did thoughts of suicide start manifesting?
I don't think I really, except for rare occasions, I didn't really think like about suicide a lot.
Right.
But I wanted, I just didn't want to be in pain anymore. So I don't think I really thought about it too much until like I was in like my 20s.
Right.
And that's when like things like cutting was more out of control. Was I eating disordered yet? Oh, no, I was already eating disordered. I don't think I was an active eating disorder at that time. But I was starting to deal with more of my family issues and my past issues and just feeling bad all the time. And I didn't want to feel bad at that point. And I had an arsenal of meds, because you always had to have a stash, just in case. And I did have plans. I was going to be going away for the weekend, with my sponsor at the time and their partner and maybe some other people. I don't even remember at this point. And I made a plan in my head to, because at one point they were going to like be off like on a bike ride or something. And I would be staying back at the house. And I made the plan that like, okay, when they're gone, I'm going to take a bottle of painkillers and they'll find me when they get back. And thankfully, that morning I also cut myself and told my sponsor about it. And she said, I don't feel safe leaving you alone in our cabin or wherever we were going. So you're not going. That snafu'd my plan. I don't know why. Like I never thought to like do it just at my house. There was something like I wanted to be found, and I don't know if I wanted to be found so that someone would know what happened or that there would be a chance that I could be saved. I never thought that all the way through. But that snafu'd my plan. And when I told her about it, she's like, yep, you're going to therapy. She's like, yeah, you need to go to therapy. You need to go back to therapy. So,
and that's the thing that I think maybe a lot of people don't realize is that you're going to develop a series of coping mechanisms no matter what, whether you get them from somewhere else or if you start developing some things on your own. Right. If you've got some level of a survival instinct, even a very, very weak one, you're going to develop some coping mechanisms that you think are going to work for you, whether they're healthy or not.
Right.
So where did you first start getting the good ones?
when did that happen? Yes. I'm alive today, so I think there is something there.
Yeah.
So when did that happen? I think it probably really started when I started like doing my own research into like self-injury and being an incest survivor and just like learn. Just part of it was very validating to be like, oh, like that's like that makes perfect sense. Like this person is telling my story, or I found a list of my 37 common side effects of being, you know, an incest survivor, after effects. And I was like, I have 26 of these. And things I didn't even think were issues was like, oh, got it. Like, and so I think through that, I started learning, about, you know, self, you know, basic self-care. And part of it, I think, was just, I was out on my own, away from my family, you know, day-to-day dynamics. So it put me in a position that it broke that, like, day-to-day, that institutionalization I felt at home, to be like, oh, I'm now responsible for my own, you know, what I eat, when I sleep, what I do with my free time. And I think that that provided space for me to start, like, figuring some of these things out, just, like, you know, like early adulting.
Yeah.
I started going to therapy, and that helped a lot. When I first started therapy, like, I barely had any feelings. Like, I think I had two. I had angry and okay, but not a whole lot more than that. And so I had to learn about, like, how do you have feelings? things that, like, normal people, you know, healthy people don't, you know, they don't have that. I think there was a lot of opportunities to, like, do, like, some, like, self-reparenting and practice self-care, even though there were times when, like, a therapist would suggest something and I know I rolled my eyes. I think she suggested, like, I, like, you know, drink some decaf. And I was like, yeah, that's not going to happen.
Oh, you're adorable.
I was just like, yeah, that's cute. No, yeah. I'm gonna, this coffee, you know, it's going to be the real deal. So, yeah.
No, there are certain things that you've just got to make peace with. You know, I know that caffeine is not one of those things that's great for you, but, you know, I'm willing to live with it.
Yeah. And instead of being, I don't know, a 4-6 cup a day person, I'm now like a 1.5. So, you know,
slowly, that's not bad.
But, no, you know, slowly but surely, and just, yeah.
Yeah.
I think
just, and you, like, can really enjoy the hell out of it.
Well, I don't know if I really enjoy the hell out of it now, because I'm vegan, so there's no cream and sugar in it, but...
Oh, well, you just got to get the right coffee.
I honestly don't actually like the taste of coffee. I like the effect of coffee, so...
Fair, like, enough.
I'm that person when I'm traveling, I'm just as likely to just throw my caffeine pills in my bag and just be like, all right, like, there we go, wake up. I don't need... You know, I'm not going to, like, my choices are just pop a pill in your hotel room or troop down the street to get like real coffee. Like, no, just give me a pill. Let's go.
Utility.
Exactly. So, yeah, I think that's kind of been it. And just, like, taking suggestions. And I do realize that I do work well in a coached relationship. Mm-hmm. So, I guess growing up with a coach who kept me alive. So now I am training for my first half Ironman race. And before that, I did my first marathon, and I hired a coach. So he tells me what my workouts are versus me, you know, deciding what I'm doing that day. And he has the authority, and I respect it, to bench me when need be. or to say, you're going to physical therapy and getting this, you know, muscle body issue worked out. I go to therapy, and, you know, I don't think of him as my coach, but, you know, he gets to make suggestions that I tend to, you know, at least try. I look at some of the things he tells me to do with, like, field trips. Like, I took a field trip to a nutritionist. I didn't, like, like, all right, let's try this. Like, all right.
Again, very goal-oriented.
Yeah. And, like, for a long time, I had a sponsor in 12-step. And one of the things he required or suggested was every day I had to email him and tell him how I was feeling. So that also meant once a day, I had to stop and think, how am I feeling? And actually, I think that was really important in my recovery.
Yeah. Are you able to sit with your own thoughts in silence very easily now?
No.
No?
No. I'm not even doing this interview sitting down. I'm pacing around my condo. No. And like one of the 12 steps.
So you're a shark.
I'm a what?
You're a shark. You can't stop moving. You've got to keep moving or you'll die.
There are a handful of things that will get me to stop moving. Like sleep. Even then I know I move. Acupuncture will get me to stop moving because there's needles in my body. But the whole sit quietly and meditate, no. Somebody suggested I try it once. They said, try for 5 minutes. I didn't even make it to two.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the 12 steps is after your fifth step, you go sit quietly for an hour. That is my least favorite of all the steps. Like, that's the one I dread the most. It's not the sharing your fourth step with somebody is less scary than having to go sit by myself for an hour.
That's a tough one for me too. I've been kind of trying to get better with meditations and sitting with silence for a while now, and it's something that it's still difficult because when the silence comes in, that's typically just a vacuum for a bunch of other things that I should probably be addressing because they'll fill that space.
One of the challenges with this race I'm doing coming up, earbuds aren't allowed. So you are alone with your thoughts the whole race. Same thing happens with swimming. I was like, when I bike, when I run, I can have music on if I want. When I swim, it's just my thoughts.
There are times when, I'll run a race and I'll keep the earbuds out and I notice that there's actually a lot going on and you can almost get kind of hypnotized by it.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, maybe that's something, but that is a pretty long run, the Ironman.
Yeah, I mean, this year I'm doing the half Ironman, but then the plan is next year to do the full, and that's up to 17 hours.
Well,
so.
The half Ironman's not fucking around either.
No, it's not. But that's up to 8 hours. I'm hoping to do it much less than that, but yeah, but definitely, on race day, you do have other things keeping, other shiny things to look at. I call it reverse people watching where you're moving, they're still, and you're watching. But it's not something I do easily, often, or voluntarily. So
how are you with personal relationships with other people?
Would you like to be a little more specific?
No.
Okay.
No, okay. I mean, honestly, in all respects, because in a lot of ways it seems like people have really let you down in a lot of ways, and you managed to find a way to pick yourself up and keep going. And for the most part, all of that sounds really healthy and like you've worked on it and you've made a solid effort to come out the other side as, a more or less a whole human being who's made peace with a lot of stuff. And, that doesn't necessarily mean completely overcame, but making peace is important for you to be able to move forward as a person. But that said, making peace with things can sometimes either make you at peace alone without the need of other human beings so much, or it can make you have an easier time with relationships with other people where previously you weren't. So with people having let you down as much as they have, just friendships, partners, especially... how are you able to have sex with other people having been through everything. I mean, it just you said to be blunt.
Let me cover the scope for you.
I think that's an important question.
It is. No, it definitely is. So the boundary that I've set in my life, for the most part, with a handful of exceptions, is if you accept my rapist who has had no repercussions, legally or otherwise, if you accept him in your life, whether that's relative, friendship, again, there's with 4, maybe 5 exceptions, you don't get to be part of my life. Like, if you support him, you're one of those people who says, well, I don't really know what happened. I don't really know who to believe. Like, yeah, that's your way of saying you think I might be lying.
Right.
So you're out. I haven't attended an all family activity since 2011. And I have no intention I've gone to one. I went to a funeral, and it was for a relative that I liked who was nice to me, who married into the family. So maybe that's why. weddings and reunions, which there is a reunion every year that I don't attend. So I don't do that. I still get invited to stuff sometimes, and I still sometimes get emails or cards, and it's like, nope, just don't need to respond to that. And those who I do have contact with, it's still limited. My sister and I, we try to have a relationship. It's so awkward. We can do 24, I can go stay with them for a night, and then it's like, okay, gotta go, we're done, for another 6 months. I really limit, my contact. I haven't seen either of my parents in over a year and a half now, so I try to keep my contact with them to 24 hours a year or less. Total. Friendships, I'm really lucky that I have really good friends, people who understand, even if they haven't been through the same things I've been through, they get it enough that they can be loving, supportive, empathetic, in their own ways sometimes. And some of them have been through, especially since I'm in 12 step. There are plenty of people who have gone through stuff that I've been through. So we can talk bluntly about our feelings, our families, what we're going through, what we're thinking. Whenever we have a great idea, we all know to run it past somebody else.
Yeah.
For our own safety. So I do have, those people who I have found. I want to say I found my tribe, but that's cultural misappropriation. I found my people.
Yes.
who I can talk to and who get it, and I'm actually still close with my gymnastics family. On Facebook, those are the people I reach out to and think about when I need something. Whereas other people might reach out to relatives, I reach out to my teammates. So I feel like I have been lucky in the friends department, though I will say that I don't have a lot of close friends. Part of that may be that I just suck at having a social life, and I don't even think to plan things, but it's kind of true.
But how many people do you really need? I mean, as long as you've got some human interaction that's meaningful in your life, honestly, it doesn't matter how much of it there is. It just matters, what is the quality of it?
Exactly. And I've always been an introverted person, so I don't need a whole lot. When people are like, oh, we're going to go to this concert, I think oh, that sounds like self-torture. we have a sci-fi geek convention every May with, it's called Phoenix Comic Fest, and I go and I speak at it. The idea of having to navigate the hallways and all the people is oh god, this is gonna suck so much. So, yeah, I know my limits. And then being sober, I don't hang out with non-sober people because they're really not that they're not as charming as they think they are when they're wasted. So,
no.
No.
I was the drummer in a band for years and years. I'm still a drummer, but it was one of those things where we would play bars and places that served alcohol and stuff like that. And for years, I was just a teetotal guy, just because mm-hmm. I didn't really have an interest in it.
Yeah.
And I really found everything other than being on stage, you know, unbearable. I really liked playing the drums. I liked playing for an audience. I liked mm-hmm. meeting people. But man, did I not like being around people who were wasted.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
I totally get that. So, yeah. So how about like relationships on a deeper level? Are you able to find like close relationships with, you know, with someone you can be intimate with?
Thankfully, yes. The number of people I will date is pretty low, and I think the number of people who would date me is pretty low, partly because I'm picky about certain things that a lot of people are like, oh yeah, I like Game of Thrones, and I'm like, are you serious? That's the most disgusting sexist thing I've ever watched. I watched one episode to see what the whole, like, what everyone was all going crazy about, and I went, holy shit, what is wrong with you people?
Yeah.
If you're a Game of Thrones fan, you're out.
It's a good thing you didn't make it to the relationship with the brother and sister.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, like just hearing about some of that shit, like caused like some PTSD shit in me.
Yeah.
Fuck. Can I date? Yes. Do I date? Rarely. Can I have sex? Thank God, yes. No, I can. I can enjoy it. Yay for that. One of my things is the first time I have sex with a person, I tend to, my brain knows where I am and is, you know, consenting and everything's great. But I don't think my body can tell the difference between a new partner and being attacked.
Yeah.
So afterwards, I literally shake like a leaf. And it's something like I have no control over it. It used to happen every time I had sex when I first started having, you know, sex voluntarily.
Yeah.
And now it tends to only happen the first time. And I just, you know, warned my partner, like, this is going to happen, you know. Don't worry, I'm not having a seizure or anything. And it's not like that. It's not like seizure caliber shaking either. But I'm like, no, just spoon me and I'll be, you know, and it'll settle down in a little bit and just make sure that, you know, talk to me enough that like I'm staying present in, where I am and it's my brain isn't heading off to Flashbacksville or something.
Yeah. Have you ever explored any therapy in that regard, or has this just been, a lot of trial and error?
No, I think it's been mostly just trial and error stuff. And
because you're working on yourself in other ways anyway.
Right, exactly. So, given the other stuff I get to work on, shaking a little bit, as long as I'm not, having, major flashback issues or anything, which...
Sure.
Is rare. Sometimes there's flashes of things that people are. I am so glad, we don't have the ability to read each other's minds because people do. Like, you do not want to know what goes through my head sometimes.
Yeah.
Or what flashes hit randomly that thankfully I can mostly just disregard and just be like, go away. But yeah. So thankfully, for the most part, my sex life is something that is enjoyable, voluntary, all good. I have had a history of picking people who are nice enough people. They're nice, they got their shit together, but they tend to be somebody where we're basically using each other for sex.
Yeah.
So, and my therapist will call, will remind me that, like, yeah, like, you pick people who don't treat you as well as you should be, because that's your history. So that's something I try to be more cognizant of, when, you know, when I'm considering a prospective partner, or being aware of, like, hey, if this is someone who's just going to be a fuck buddy, like, I know what I'm doing and I'm not expecting more.
Yeah. So, I think if you set those kind of boundaries with people right out of the gate, nobody's really being exploited or used, because everyone agrees to the terms at the beginning.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, I mean, it sounds like you have done a lot of work to be able to get yourself to the place where you can, let yourself, you know, I mean, we've laughed about things here. We've joked about stuff. We've talked about some dark things, and I've definitely, felt a lot of sadness and joy and all kinds of stuff while we've been having this conversation. Mm-hmm. And I think that for you to be able to talk about, all of these things is maybe a way forward for a lot of people, because sexual assault is something that is not rare. It happens to a lot of people, and a lot more people than we know.
Oh yeah. It's like, from what I've heard from various sources, by the age of 18, 1 in 4 females, so take your high school class and do that math.
Yeah.
That's a lot. And for boys, like, the numbers are all over the place in terms of, like, the percentages.
Yeah.
The one that I heard, there's a whole organization around it, is called 1 in 6. So I've heard as high as 1 in 5, but so,
yeah.
So, and I also saw one the other day that said like 1 in 19. I was like, no,
there's no way.
I'm like, there's a lot of people lying in that, in that survey. So yeah, no, it is really prevalent, and it's something we don't talk about. And we have institutions set up to downplay it. And I understand, like, in the legal system, we have a court of law where it's about what you can prove, and I get it. I totally understand that. But that also results in a lower percentage of people being convicted than have actually committed, just because a lot of times, by the if you want to report, if the evidence is gone, it's, he said, or, you know, person one says, person two says, and it's a lot harder to get a conviction. So, and plus the whole stigma and the shame and.
Yeah. Because there's a barrier just to saying something. The very first barrier you're going to hit is someone saying, I don't believe you. Prove it. That's the very first barrier you're going to hit. Who wants about that?
Right. Well, I think that'd be the first barrier, is getting over, you know, getting past your own shame, and maybe blaming yourself, and just being willing to say something.
Oh my God.
And then the worst thing that could happen is someone saying, I don't believe you, or something like that. Which, if that happens the first time, it might be a long time before you say anything again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something that I feel needs more attention, and it needs more people being willing to say something about it. And I completely understand why people don't.
I do too. But like, when I do, it's most of the time I see the nods of validation from, like, people in the audience, if I'm talking to a group, or not uncommon, the person I tell says, I've been through something like that too. So, it's not, and you are in, you know, people who are sexually assaulted are a minority, thank goodness.
Yeah.
But a substantial minority. And it's something that we don't talk about.
Right. Yeah. I didn't address, being raped, until last year. I'd never really said it out loud. It was something that happened to me, 25 years ago, something like that. And honestly, I don't know if I had ever really said it out loud. And I was having a conversation with someone, and we talked about it. And it just so happened we were on microphones. And then after the episode was done, I sat on it for like a month because I didn't know if I could put that out in the world.
Sure.
That was a tough thing. And that's something that happens to so many other people. And I'm safe as a human being. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a grown person. I'm married. I got kids. I got a house. I got a dog. I got all the stuff, you know, like I won Monopoly, you know, so there's nothing that's going to happen to me. I'm not really worried that people are going to look at me funny or anything like that. So what was really the drive behind that? It was shame. And I think that ultimately I decided, you know, if I'm going to be truthful with people, and if I'm going to expect people to be truthful with me as the idea of shedding the stigma of mental illness, and that there's a way forward to survive as a human being, even though there's, you know, something that might not be wired the same as everybody else, I've got to be willing to talk about this as well, because it is something that could help people. It is something that could help people find a way forward. And hearing stories like yours, they definitely make me want to be braver. And I think that they'll make other people want to be braver too.
Yeah, I agree. And given the prevalence of, you know, mental illness in society, I remember when I was getting my master's degree, I think they said like 1 in 5 people at any time are dealing with a mental illness. So again, not in the minority.
Yeah.
So whether you are, you know, just having it or in therapy or taking meds or all of the above, yeah, it's again, minority, but substantial minorities.
Yeah. Well, this has been a complete honor. I want to thank you for talking to me and telling me your story, and being so open to this whole experience. And I just can't thank you enough. Thanks for talking to me.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I feel like I should, like, come with a disclaimer to say, like, I still go to meetings. I'm still in therapy. I take meds. I've only been on meds for, like, the last 5 years. And, oh, my God, we are all better people for it. Seriously, I am grateful to the manufacturers of my meds. And that took a while for me to deal with that stigma. But, yeah, so, you know, do I have my shit together day to day? Close enough. But yeah, like anybody who listening, if you're thinking like, oh, you know, they have their shit together, why can't I? It's like, trust me, do not compare my outsides to your insides. Cause trust me, I do that all the time and it's not worth it. We're all fucked up in our own ways.
All in our own ways. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for tuning in and listening each and every week. And you know what? If you want to find some great guests for your show, or you're just thinking about putting your foot in the water, you can always go to podcastguests.com and sign up for free, and you'll find some great people to talk to, like Ruth. Do you want to get a little more Ruth in your life? I know you do, because I know I did. So what you want to do is go to www.undeniableruth.com or twitter.com/RBCarter. And that's all I got for this week, everybody. I really had a fantastic time. 50 episodes in the can, and you people are the reason all of this is happening. I can't thank you enough for the personal journey that I've been allowed to go on through all of this. And as always, don't kill yourselves out there.